Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Well, hello everyone from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio. We hope you're having a great evening. Hope you're not underwater. Gosh, the flooding that's going on right now through the southeast, clear over to Virginia and down through the state of Florida. It's been just terrible, and God bless all the folks that may be listening from that part of the country. Keep your socks dry. That's all I can say. Manning the studio tonight, of course, is Billy Willard. He keeps us on the air from Manassas, Virginia. And we've got a fantastic show planned for you tonight. Bob Jackson, the legendary Yellowstone Park Ranger, is going to be with us as we help promote Billy Willard and his cohort. They call him the Creature Seeker. Their Creature Weekend coming up in May, the 15th and 16th, I believe. Is that correct, Billy?
Yeah, it'll be May 16th through the 18th.
So we'll be talking about that tonight and talking to what I've always considered one of the most credible witnesses to the Sasquatch legend, Bob Jackson. And as always, from the Wild World News Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, newly renovated, now HD, it is truly spectacular. I had an opportunity to see them recently. The Honorable, Distinguished, and always on time, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Batson. Well, it's 50 degrees here in Indianapolis tonight, and I bet you had to put sweaters on the alligators tonight.
You know, the alligators aren't a bit happy with me right now. We had 70-degree weather going, you know?
Yep.
And all of a sudden, boom, it just got cold. So I don't know what happened, but, that's what's going on. Not good.
Well, at least they have sweaters.
Yes, they do. This part of Wild World, you're on it tonight, Dr. Day, is brought to you by Bigfoot.com, Chautauqua Lake. Let me find my piece of paper. I'm going to have this all screwed up. Chautauqua Lake Bigfoot Weekend and Expo. It was last April 26th, 27th, and 28th. Now available on video on demand for just $4.99. 6 hours of footage if you're a fan of Finding Bigfoot or some of the other Discovery Channel, Mysterious Monsters and all that stuff. Hey, this is far and above. You get 6 hours of video, and it's available at ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com. They make it possible for Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News for May 1st. May Day, May Day.
It is May Day, May Day.
Yep, it's May Day.
Yeah.
Now, here's some kind of sad news. Atlanta Zoo visitors can say goodbye to pandas Z-Lan and Poe this weekend.
What happened?
Yes, well, they will be moved on May 7th to China's research base of giant panda breeding. So they were just on loan.
Yeah, the lease has run out. You know, we talked about this earlier. You know what it costs, to lease a panda for a year from the fine people of China?
I'm just going to take a guess, $37.
No, that is incorrect. $1 million. $1 million.
Ouch.
Yes.
And we had two of them.
Yeah, so that's $2 million. Now, let's say they gave him a deal, but I don't know about that for sure. But, yeah, that's what's involved there.
Well, the news isn't so bad because they're losing two pandas, but their parents, Loon Loon and Yang Yang, will stay at the zoo along with twin 9-month-old pandas.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
So that's fine. But yeah. Wait a minute. This just in, Zoo Atlanta officials said that the departure of the two giant pandas will be pushed back by almost a week.
Oh, get an extra
week. Yeah. Yeah, we just got that news. So it'll be like May 12th when the pandas will be moved. But if you want to see them, this weekend will be the last time.
Your staff is on top of it tonight.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, that's why we have so many listeners. They want to know what's going on.
That's absolutely correct.
All right. Now, for our listeners in Boston, yes, the squad.
Oh, we have one. Go ahead.
At least one, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the Swans will be returning to the public garden there. Now, the Swans named Romeo and Juliet were returned to the park's lagoon during a ceremony that included a parade, a brass band, face painting, and other activities for children, including a reading of Make Way for Ducklings.
Mm.
These must be some pretty important swans.
They must be.
And people in Boston must... not have a lot to do.
Do we have Bruce Harrington on the line yet?
I don't think he's here.
Oh, okay.
All right, no Bruce yet. All right, well, if you live in moose country, drivers are being warned to be on the lookout for moose this time of the year. Fish and Wildlife Department officials said moose are on the move and likely to be crossing roads, often after dark or in the early morning as they move from their wintering areas to the spring feeding spots.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about that?
And let me tell you, you do not want to hit a moose when you're doing 65 miles an hour.
I take that back. My father's friend hit a buffalo at that speed.
Oh, my.
Yes, and it wasn't pretty.
Yeah,
anyway, go ahead.
Well, as we reported, and Bob can tell us, too, that this time of the year, the bison are moving, and like we reported a couple of weeks ago, a couple were killed. That's why we're asking everybody to slow down and keep your eyes open.
Is that true, Bob?
It happens every spring. I haven't followed that close on what's happening here, but ermine and Yellowstone, West Yellowstone, is probably where it happened. Although the animals coming back from the Yellowstone Valley down by Gardner could very well have been there, too.
What about
They have at least one killed on the West Yellowstone, US 191, because they're going faster there, and they got a lot of semis going that road.
Yeah.
That's right.
What about this deal that the bison are leaving because Yellowstone's about to explode because of thermal activity?
I don't think, the thing came out of Yellowstone after that was that film was actually, or picture was of buffalo going back into the park instead of leaving the park. So I don't think, I've been around enough as far as earthquakes and animals, and I don't see that much of a correlation, although they say like tidal waves, those animals know that thing's coming in, so they go to higher ground.
Yeah.
So I don't know where the animals would go, whether it's elk or buffalo in Yellowstone.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. That's the voice of Bob Jackson.
Which we'll be talking to a little later in the show.
Yeah.
And it's you must hang out with us and Bob because... Bob is the true thing.
Yes, he is.
All right. Well, if you're wondering why there are so many black flies in your neighborhood in Beckley, West Virginia, it's because the program has used up all of its funding because of a rainy season in 2013. So the black flies will be abundant this year. And it's because you spent all your money.
I've been to Beckley, West Virginia before. It's I wonder why they have all those black flies. That's weird.
Well, they got to live somewhere.
Yes, they do.
Well, if you're in downtown Wisconsin, and it kind of smells like low tide. Well, here's why. The state's first indoor shrimp farm is in the heart of the Kickapoo Valley. Yeah, the family-owned Dairyland Shrimp raises Pacific White Shrimp year-round in a large red building right downtown.
Well,
yeah,
sounds kind of shrimpy.
Yeah, you know, low tide.
Yeah, low tide.
In downtown Westby.
Yep.
All right, in other news, in a nighttime theft, robbers broke into a South African provincial parks office with a 24-hour security service and used a grinder to break into a safe holding a stockpile of rhino horn worth a fortune on the illegal market in parts of Asia.
Huh.
Now, the weekend heist in the northwest city of Nesprut was a blow to effects to curb the trade in rhino horns, which has surged in the recent years.
Mm.
And they use it as an aphrodisiac.
Wouldn't it be easier to just get a six-pack of beer?
I would think so, yeah.
You better get some good, mature buffalo meat. That's what the Indians said. Worked the best of all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Gave more power. Mature animals, buffalo. Yeah.
Oh, my.
I tell all of our customers that, too, our older ones. We say, hey, eat this and you won't need Viagra. And it's true, too. It works.
I'll be calling you after this program.
Well, I'm a believer.
Mixed martial art, mixed martial art guys and the power lifters and Mr. Iowa's, yeah, they all get our meat from the mature bulls. Yeah,
oh,
it works the best. Better than rhino horn. It doesn't screw up or anything else either. So, okay. Sorry to interject. But.
Oh, that's, we love
thanks,
that.
Bob. Now I'm hungry.
I want a burger.
All right, let's head off to Salt Lake City, Utah. Now, Gerald Efflers, 35, pleaded not guilty on charges of stealing a fossilized dinosaur footprint.
Mm.
Now, he's accused of dislodging a piece of limestone with a three-toed ancient dinosaur track from Hell's Revenge Trail in Sand Flats Recreation Area near Moab.
Mm.
Now, here's the thing. He stole some dinosaur footprints, and now his fingerprints are going to be famous.
Well, my Lord.
Famous dinosaur prints? Famous fingerprints.
Well, I'll be...
All right, now, for all you turkeys who live in Portland, Maine, it's turkey hunting season. So, don't leave the house.
Can I tell you my famous turkey story?
Please.
We were at a outdoor show, and we had several turkeys on exhibit. And who should walk up to the exhibit but some turkey hunters with their turkey calls?
And cars off.
They stood there, and they sounded off those calls for a good 10-15 minutes, and the turkeys weren't saying anything. I mean, they were just quiet. So I walked up between amongst all these camouflaged turkey callers and stuck my head in there, and I just go, gobble, gobble, gobble. And that turkey wouldn't shut up. They walked away. They were so disgusted.
You know why? Because they probably spent $60 on those turkey calls.
Well, you know what they cost? You're right. And the Duck Dynasty boys, those duck calls, and up to $135. My gosh. What Barnum and Bailey say? There's a sucker born every minute.
Yeah, I'd just go to the store and buy a duck, I guess.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, Providence, Rhode Island. Now, you don't get to hear about this very often, but two people were attacked by a rabid raccoon, and you know what that means.
Oh, shots in the belly.
Shots in the belly.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now, the Arizona Fish and Game Department said it will put 21,000 juvenile rainbow trout in the Willow Beach National Fish Hatchery which is along the Colorado River south of the Hoover Dam to boost fishing activity in the Mojave County.
Well.
Now, this is going on all across the states. We are restocking. We're trying to get our fish back to power after that awful winter we had, which destroyed a lot of fish, turtles, and, you know, anything that lives in the water. The winter was so bad.
Yeah.
All right, now, Chaco National Historical Parks has celebrated the fact that it's been voted the best place in the United States for sky viewing. You want to go out and look at the stars? Chaco Canyon is the place to go.
My backyard's not bad.
I tell you, I'm from Kansas, and we're in the middle of Kansas in the summer.
Mm.
It's like being out at sea.
Yeah.
More stars than you can count.
Oh,
well,
yeah,
how are we doing on time? Well, we're running just a tiny bit long. Let's get on with the Wild World Facts of the Day.
Okay.
All right, a shark is the only fish that can blink both eyes.
Really?
Yeah, kind of interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Now, the average garden variety caterpillar has 248 muscles in its head.
Hmm. 248.
Yes, have you ever been bitten by a caterpillar?
No, I think I have. It doesn't feel good.
It doesn't feel good, that's right.
Yeah.
Why is that? Because they have 248 muscles on their head.
Yeah.
All right, now we're going to do a human animal fact tonight.
Uh-oh.
Well, several in this one fact. Now, the average human body contains enough sulfur to kill all the fleas on an average dog. It contains enough carbon to make 900 pencils, enough potassium to fire a toy cannon, enough fat to make 7 bars of soap, you know, depending on, yeah, and enough phosphorus to make 2,200 match heads.
Wow.
And enough water to fill a 10-gallon tank. Yes, unbelievable.
It is.
Are the Wild World Facts of the Night. That's the Wild World News for May Day.
Oh, once again, a great job done by Dr. Day and his staff at the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana, always doing a wonderful job. We always appreciate their efforts. It's a fantastic. We want to remind everyone, check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. Tells us all about our wildlife rescue work that we do, also our wildlife education programs. And our wonderful Facebook page, Larry the Animal Guy and Friends, has lots of animal facts and pictures and videos. And some of the latest things we've been involved with, and we encourage you to do so. Is Mrs. Swihart here tonight?
I don't think so.
Oh, well. It's that time, everybody, with our very special guest and a very special night here on Wild World. Billy Willard and his cohort from the fine community of Boston, Massachusetts, Bruce Harriet. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Good evening on my part. Yeah.
Do we not have Bruce?
He's here.
Oh. Did we lose him?
Billy, did you blow my cover?
And they're talking about their fantastic weekend coming up.
Sorry, I was busy checking my stash of rhino horn to make sure no one.
Oh, it was you.
No one was breaking into my safe. Because if you got a stash of rhino horn, you want to keep it in the safe as opposed to your cash and jewels.
Oh, yes. The creature seeker himself. Wow. Man alive. And our very special guest tonight, as we promote the Creature Weekend coming up, what were those dates again, Billy Willard?
That would be May 16th through the 18th.
And you know the 16th is going to be a very special day there for that event. You know why, don't you?
Why is that?
Because of the prime rib dinner.
No, it's my birthday.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Well, that was a close second, Larry.
And gentlemen, our very special guest who's been so kind to join us here tonight, the legendary Yellowstone Park Ranger who for
over 30 years patrolled the most remote area in the United States, hunting poachers by himself, doing a wonderful job in arresting more poachers in Yellowstone than all the nature's rangers combined, excuse me. Our good friend from Iowa, bison rancher Bob Jackson.
Thank you, and you swelled my head up too much, so we'll see if some words can come out after it. My tongue is that swelled, so anyway, go ahead.
You got it. So, boys, tell us about your big weekend before we get into Mr. Jackson and his knowledge on the legendary, I shouldn't say legendary anymore, Bigfoot or Sasquatch. That's a poor choice of words.
All right, who's going to start? Bruce, you will start?
Well, you know, I'll let you start, Billy.
Okay. Well, as we mentioned before, May 16th through the 18th, 2014, Creature Weekend event. We're going to start out Friday by folks arriving and kind of introducing the speakers, kind of as a meet-and-greet type thing. And then that evening, we're having a nice prime rib dinner.
Oh, my.
And for those, you know, the vegetarian type, we've got a vegetarian meal as well. But I got to go for the prime rib.
Absolutely.
Yep, and then we're going to have a special presentation given by Mr. Bill Munns, as many knows, is one of the most recent fellows that's worked on the Patterson-Gimlin film. He's a Hollywood costume maker, and he knows quite a bit about suits. So
he does. Billy, I asked him if he could do a makeover for Larry Bassman, and he said he's a special effects guy, but he's not like a magician.
You know, I have a history that I'm not going to discuss tonight on this program, but but yeah, Bill Munns is he's worked on several Hollywood movies, I believe Planet of the Apes, and he knows costumes. And Bob, you're familiar with the Patterson-Gimlin film, correct?
I don't know what the name of it is. I know that one where a number of years ago out in Washington or Oregon where they had this one along the shoreline that turned and looked at him. Is that the one you're referring to?
That's the one we're talking about.
Yeah.
What did you think about that film?
Or what? You don't even know where it was.
It looks legit to me. I mean, for the little I know, the one I saw didn't turn towards me. It doesn't mean that they can't turn towards you. You know, he just wanted to get away. So, anyway. But, yeah, it's the arms, everything, it looked good. Yeah, it looked like mine. His was it looked like that one was taller than mine. But I'm sure, just like humans, they're different heights.
Bob, did you know that the day after Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin shot that footage at Bluff Creek, the day after, they asked one question. Do you know what that question was?
What?
Where was Larry Batson? The similarity was just uncanny.
I was in high school. I'll have you know. What's that?
You guys are so young.
Yeah. I think I was a sophomore in high school, if my memory's correct.
Wasn't it like early 70s or something like that when that picture or film?
67.
Huh?
67, wasn't it?
Early 67. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I was just 2 years out of high school. So.
Yeah, and even to this day, it can't be... no one has shown me the proof that it is a fake because of, if you know anything about animals or anything like that, and of course now you've just sealed the deal, Bob, when you said it resembled the one that you saw.
Mine was a little darker than that picture there, but of course I don't know what film does to the color on it, but I'm sure there's different color variations too, a little bit too. Mine... okay, just like there are grizzly bears and black bears, different colors. So I'm sure yeah, anytime you have fur. Mine was black. I had a lot of hair on my chest and back, but now it's getting a little bit lighter colored.
There. It happens.
Well, yeah. Well, maybe you should, because I know there's people that haven't heard from your words, the exact things that occurred that day that you had your, and even the things that happened before the sighting that made you start thinking about this.
Hey, Larry, can we finish talking about Creature Weekend?
Yeah. We were going to go back to it.
You're all over the place, Larry.
Go ahead and talk about your Creature Weekend.
You know what? I don't want to talk about it now.
No. Go ahead.
You know, Larry, when you come on our show and you give me a hard time, this is payback for that. Just so you know. Just so you know, Larry.
Well, just so I know. It won't make any difference.
You torment me on the show in front of all my listeners, so this is payback.
All right, let's hear about your Creature Weekend before Mr. J.
Oh, hey, I don't want to, you know, take up a lot of your time, Larry.
Well, we have lots of
Lord,
time.
Lord knows you call our show and then take us off on tangents all the time, so.
We have lots of time, Bruce. I mean, we have 90 minutes we need to fill. So,
back in Kansas, one of the rangers in Yellowstone grew up in Kansas, went to college there. Mm-hmm. One time we were in the backcountry at a backcountry cabin talking, because there was lightning out, and he started talking about ball lightning. I'd never seen it in Iowa or out west, but he saw it twice, ball lightning, where it's bouncing on the dam on this reservoir this one time. So then I looked it up, and there is ball lightning. Yeah, it bounces. Mm-hmm. So,
yep.
Have you seen
yep.
that out in Kansas? Yeah.
I have not seen it, but I've heard of it.
Dr. Yeah. Day would know. Yeah.
Well, I haven't. I'm from Kansas, and I hadn't seen it personally, but my grandfather told me about it.
Mm.
Where basically a fireball dropped out of the sky, stopped a couple of feet before the ground, kind of floated for a short distance over the ground, and then exploded. And he described it as a glowing mass of what he said looked like worms squirming around the surface.
Hmm. Yeah.
Let's look at some pictures.
You know one
bro.
Thing Kansas doesn't have, Larry?
What's that?
A conference called Creature Weekend that's going on this day, May 16th through the 18th.
Mm-hmm.
And the conference is actually on May 17th.
Uh-huh.
So after the dinner, Friday night, the following morning, around 10 o'clock, the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society, a bunch of nice folks, are going to be giving a presentation. And that presentation is going to run for about an hour and a half or so. Then we're going to break for lunch, and we're going to start seating people at 1. The conference will actually begin at 2 o'clock, and then we have the lineup of speakers are Bill Munns, as Billy already mentioned, but also Dr. Meldrum.
Oh.
And everyone, you know Dr. Meldrum.
Sasquatch meet, or Legend Meets Science.
That's right.
Yeah.
He's got that book, Legend Meets Science. And also John Mindzinski. John Mindzinski is a guy who is, he spent most of his life as a wildlife biologist,
mm-hmm.
tracking sheep, and I think he did some work with grizzly bears out in the Sierras, and so he'll be there. John is actually, I've had the opportunity to speak with him on the phone a couple of times. He's actually a really fascinating guy. I mean, Bigfooting aside, he plays the piano at this bar in Wyoming. He is an avid motorcyclist, and he is probably one of the most diehard motorcyclists that I know of. And I like to fancy myself as a motorcycle enthusiast, but this guy is diehard, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And also we have Tim Stover, who will be talking about some work he's been doing in Ohio, and Doug Waller, who be giving us some updates about recent sightings at Salt Fork State Park in Ohio also.
Oh.
So
And where is this event occurring at?
This event is occurring at Salt Fork State Park Lodge, which is in Cambridge, Ohio, right at the intersection of 77 and 70. So we have tickets online. If you go to www.creatureweekend.com, and you can purchase your tickets there, and there's directions on how to get to the lodge, and we have the schedule online, as well as the biographies of the speakers. And then, Billy, do you want to talk about the Creature Weekend experience?
Yeah, we're going to do something. Yeah, it'll be after the conference late Saturday night. We're doing something a little different. Hasn't been done. And basically what we're doing is we're going to take groups of people out into the woods, and they're going to be involved in a little bit of a competition. And that competition is to find out how well you can use your senses when you're in the woods. Everything from hearing things, taking a guess of how far away the sound was, identifying sounds that you hear in the woods, and then, they want to make sure they bring a camera, too, because this is going to kind of be a test to see, when something happens in the woods, are you prepared? So...
Well, we have the expert on the line with us tonight, as far as that's concerned.
Yeah, you got to be prepared.
I did a lot of night riding.
That's
right. I did a lot of night riding.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
And you got to be ready, and that's really what this is geared to do. And of course, we'll be giving out awards and stuff we'll have a little test, so to speak, and people fill out the paper, and then we're going to give out awards. It'll just be something fun for young and old. And as far as we know, it's never been done before. So I think it's going to be a good time. And then Sunday, we're having a picnic/barbecue. That is being sponsored by Sasquatch Watch Radio. And Dr. Jeff Meldrum is giving a special presentation to the folks that come there about his field guide he put out, his little trifold field guide that he just recently released. And he's going to, kind of talk to people about what to look for and, footprint tracks and things like that. So it's going to be a great time.
It sounds like it. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's gonna be awesome.
Should be. Will you be there, Bruce?
I will, Larry.
Well, that might hurt the event a little bit, but we won't go there. Well, Bob, we asked Bob Jackson in past shows how long it took to become completely attuned to the out of doors. And what was your answer, Bob?
Minimum of 3 weeks. Back there where you're back there all the time, and if you're around too many people, it takes a fair amount longer. But if I could be there 3 weeks with maybe seeing a total of two or three in that time, then yeah, that's about it. 3 weeks is what it'd take to start with.
Well, it's because we're so attuned to our lives. We have so many interruptions. We have TV, we got telephone, we got all that. So I can understand that it takes some time to acclimate yourself to where your senses kind of tone down, because our senses are just blasted all day long for what we do.
Yeah. Well, where I was, they couldn't even get to AM or FM radio. Not that I would want to listen to it anyway. So I just check in on the radio once a day.
Yeah.
And then I wouldn't have the radio on either. So,
yep.
And I didn't even
yep.
talk to my horse, so I didn't have to have that interference.
Billy Willard and I performed an interesting experiment one time when we were kind of out on an expedition with a group of people. And, it's funny how if you're not looking, if you're not paying attention, how you can miss very obvious things. So, we were with a group of people, and we decided to stay behind on the trail, and then the group sort of left us. And we weren't making any attempt to hide or anything. Actually, we sat right out in the open in this clearing. And when the group came back, you know, they just passed right by us. And they had flashlights. They were, you know, they were looking around with their flashlights, but none of them saw us. And we were, Billy, how far from the trail were we, do you think?
Oh, we wasn't no more than like 30 feet. I mean, we wasn't far at all.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, I can believe that it would take 3 weeks just to, you know, just to get used to your surroundings and sort of be able to tune your senses, you know, to a different type of distraction than what you're used to, you know, with the hustle and bustle of your life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
I think on my part, probably the most spooked or on edge I ever was, well, not the only time, but I was going in what they call Pelican Valley. It's an open valley, and it's about 8 miles in to a cabin there, and I was about a mile from there, and it was all night raiding, and it was a dark night, not the darkest night I've been on, but all at once, and I was on a horse, and I had a mule pack, you know, leading, and all at once I heard this, you know, breathing on each side of the trail, and I just could see just a teeny bit, but there's probably, I was right in the middle of a herd of about 150 buffalo that were all bedded down, and some of them were like 5, 6, 7 feet from the trail, and I just tiptoed that thing, you know, on the stirrups, and luckily I had some pretty experienced horse and mule, and we rode right through them, but you can imagine if it was on the prairies and you had that stuff happen all the time as a frontiersman. I mean, horses would spook, you know, buffalo would get up all at once, but we just kept going through. But then I learned a little bit about what the life would have been on the frontier, you know, going through that herd of buffalo, bedded down at night. So
that would be, to put it mildly, exciting.
Yeah, it's like you're just barely touching the reins, and you're just, you got the tips of the feet in, and you just kind of keep going. And you let the horse know.
Yeah.
You know, you keep moving the reins just a little bit on each side, just to let him know, okay, I know what's going on. You just keep going straight ahead. And we probably had to go about, I don't know, 150 yards, 200 yards to do those. I mean, you couldn't turn around. You couldn't do anything except just stay on the trail and hope there wasn't one bedded down right in the middle of the trail, which there wasn't. So, anyway.
See, this is what you guys need to do for your creature weekend. You need to wade the guests through a herd of buffalo.
At night.
At night.
Larry, listen to your talk. You're lucky if you don't get spooked by buffalo wings. You know... You know, I love how Larry talks such a big game, but you get him out in the woods, and the guy's, you know, he's, like, fearful for his life.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, who did not have a flashlight the last time we went? Yours truly. Who did not care, did not have a flashlight?
Actually, when you're in the woods, I mean, when you're riding at night, too, you have one, but you never turn it on. You just,
yeah.
You have to go for hours and hours and hours, because if you turn it on, then you've lost all. Well, you lose your sense, and you lose your, of course, your vision, and your horse loses his vision as much. So, yeah,
yeah.
You can't turn it on. Yeah, you
well,
want to,
you know what?
But you can't.
Bob, when Billy and I came upon Larry in the woods, he was so lost, he was trying to follow a flock of geese south just to find his way out of there.
Yeah. He was following the South Star, not the North Star. Yeah.
Okay, here's the deal, Bruce, buddy. You come to Indiana, and I'm going to take you timber rattlesnake hunting, and we're going to go at night.
Larry, you know how he
no
has night. I hate the...
And we're not hunting to kill them. We're going to capture them alive.
Mm.
I don't
know.
What do you mean by we or where?
Well, just you and I.
I envy your nighttime event that you guys are putting on. I think that's great, because most people there probably won't have had, you know, that kind of opportunity, or at least not that where they really actually are doing something at night like that. Mm. So I think it's great. And to me, half of my stories are the nighttime, you know, because those are the ones you're the most alert and, yeah, nighttime. I've had my scalp move 4 times at night because of grizzlies. But I tell you, the worst I ever heard of a guy in a nighttime event was a guy that was a Yellowstone Park Company bus driver. He's a young guy, college kid. And I saw him on the trail, and he just had a little day pack, and he was way in the backcountry. And I thought, what the heck is this guy doing, you know, without much survival or anything else and stuff. And so this guy said he, on his 2 days that he had, well, he actually had a day and a half, then he'd just hoof it, you know, he'd just go from one road to the other road. And depending where it was, then sometimes he had to stay overnight, and he just had a little plastic sheet, and he'd camp illegally off the trail. But I'd, you know, after I heard my first Bigfoot, and then I'd ask people if they ever heard, you know, people that were pretty knowledgeable, if they'd ever heard anything different out there. Because, you know, it's kind of like when you're interrogating poachers, you really don't want to lead on to something, so you leave it pretty open. And this guy, you know, he told about when he was over in the upper Lamar between Pelican Valley and up over the top into Coal Creek. And definitely it's an overnight, you know, it was too far for him to go from road to road. And so he said he'd just gotten some deep woods, just, you know, real close off the trail, though, you know, no more than 20 yards. And he said all at once he woke up in the middle of the night with this thing just screaming and just making all this noise that, and I asked him to describe it, and of course it was the same noise, you know, it just kept going, except he heard it from probably no more than 10 yards away, and it was a good, probably almost 30 seconds is what it sounded like, the same as what I'd heard. So he had a Bigfoot just, you know, really yakking it up real close to him. I'm sure he knew he was a guy right there. So that was, I tell you what, it's one thing to have a bear wolf at night, but to have something like that close to you, yeah, that guy, he had it a lot worse with that Bigfoot anyway. So I don't know. I don't know if I've told you. I've probably told you that one, haven't I?
No. No, Bob, you have not.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was, that guy said he got up, he waited about a half hour, and he got up, and he got back on the trail, and he hiked all night to get out of there. He was that scared. He said there's no way he was going to stay there. Yeah.
And he was a veteran of those woods, I assume.
Well, he was a, you know, I'd never asked guys that are just yo-yos type, but yeah, this guy, I could tell he knew what he was doing, and he'd do it every days off, he'd just zoom, and he'd cover a lot of ground. Not that he had been in there oodles of years, but he definitely was doing a lot of covering, and he was a sensible guy, and yeah, it was a legitimate story, yeah. So
I remember the head ranger at Glacier, they were doing a wolf count in the winter, and he had one of the young rangers with him, and they were in a tent, and they heard this sound come out of the valley. And he just told the younger ranger, says, grab your gun, and they go. He goes, what is that? He goes, I don't have any idea. but it's not anything I'd heard before. I mean,
you know, this is not a Bigfoot one, but this other biologist and I, just freshly out of college and in Yellowstone, and we were supposed to do the fish survey on this lake right north of Heart Lake, Riddle Lake area. And, you know, just, you didn't know anything. We're from Flatlands of Iowa, both of us were. And so it just happens that, you know, we set up our tent, we've had our horses and picketed out there because we had a lot of equipment for doing studies on this lake, and we were in our tent. It was like a little miniature wall tent, and all at once it was daylight, and all we had was, he had, I think, a buck knife, and I didn't have anything. And right at morning, just real close to the tent, you know, right at daylight, we heard this, you know, thing going on, and he grabbed his knife, and then we peeked out, and there was a couple sandhill cranes. Sandhill cranes, yeah.
Well, you know, the barred owl will make some sounds that'll make you wonder, especially if you were a young scout in the woods for the first time.
Yeah.
Because they make some strange noises. We have a nest right behind our house. We've raised two owlets over the last few years that got blown out of the nest and raised them until they're ready to be released. But, boy, they make some crazy sounds. So leaves a lot to the imagination. Well, we're going to take a short break, folks. Bob Jackson's with us, Bruce Harrington, Billy Willard, the Big Creature Weekend coming up in May. And they've selected that date because it happens to fall on my birthday. I'm sorry I won't be there, but you can go ahead and christen my statue if you'd like. That would be fine. And you're listening to Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters?
It's bobcat heavy. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean? Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Here's a hot topic about our wildlands and living with the natural role of fire.
Yard work is not just a matter of pride when you live in the wildland-urban interface. It's also about survival. Here are some FireWise tips that can help protect your home from wildland fire. Prune your trees 6 to 10 feet above the ground. Remove dead leaves and branches and dispose of them before fire season. Water your lawn regularly and store firewood away from the house. Be prepared for a fire emergency by having a plan for your family and pets. Learn more at our website and then sit back and enjoy. You worked for it.
This hot topic was made possible by the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation. Learn more about the natural role of fire, how to protect your community, and get the latest fire information. Visit the National Interagency Fire Center website at NIFC.gov. That's NIFC.gov.
We're Rascal Flatts. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio. We would like to thank McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, for making it possible for us to be on Blog Talk Radio. If you've never been west to the Rockies, Colorado, you owe it to yourself. Absolutely spectacular. Right on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. I mean, you'll have bighorn sheep and elk in your backyard. Absolutely spectacular. Go to their website, McGregorMountainLodge.com. And I'll tell you, folks, now's the time to go because I've seen photographs from that area. And the scenery is absolutely magnificent. There's still snow in the mountains, and it's starting to warm up just a little bit. And you ought to yourself to go to Rocky Mountain National Park and stay at McGregorMountainLodge.com. They make it possible for Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio. Remind all of our listeners, check out our archives. Over 199 shows, it's hard to believe, with lots of different guests. Not only great guests like Bob Jackson, but also several from the rock and roll world, such as Rick Derringer and Dave Davies from the Kinks and Al Jardine. A complete variety of guests. Go to our website, www.blogtalkradio.com, and enjoy Wild World. Now been on the air for close to 4 years, which is pretty amazing, isn't it, Bruce?
You know, it is amazing, Larry, for reasons other than what you think.
And our guest tonight, very distinguished, and guys, I guess you would call him Super Ranger. Bob Jackson's with us as we help promote the Creature Weekend coming up in May, celebrating my birthday on May 16th. At Salt Creek Fork Lodge in Ohio, in the eastern part of the state, right off 70. And was it 70 and 77, guys?
Yeah, 70 and 77.
Absolutely great weekend.
Larry, did you say you're not coming?
No, I'm afraid I have to take care of black bears, tigers, alligators, baboons, lemurs, parrots, snakes. And my wife.
Oh. Well, so Friday's your birthday, but with you not coming, it's almost like it's our birthday.
Does that make any sense to you, Mr. Jackson? Huh?
You know, when my first years in Yellowstone, they used to have the ranger meetings. And that was back in the days when it was still, they had them like twice a year. And all the rangers would get together, and they'd talk about different issues and things. And, of course, the last 10 years or so, all they could talk about is who had whose case incident in and who had this paperwork that still needed to be in. But it used to be a lot of camaraderie, you know, a lot of people kind of joking back and forth and having fun. And they'd get into big arguments, and they'd, you know, somebody... got a little too rambunctious, the sergeant-at-arms, and make them put a quarter in, you know, into the bucket. But they'd talk about things like what's better, a Decker or a Sawbuck saddle, you know, and all that kind of, you know, backcountry stuff. You
sure.
know, that's how the ranger job changed in all those years. And I feel fortunate to be a part of, I don't know, the last of the field ranger type of stuff. But anyway, they had this one district ranger, and I wasn't there, but my boss was there, and he said, you know, they were yelling one side what was better, Sawbuck or Decker, and this old guy, he just stands up, and he said, this is what I think about that. And he sat down, and he had one of those farty-type bags, you know, that you put down, so it sounded like a big ripper, you know. So it was like he had to pay 25 cents, but that's the kind of stuff that I like, you know, that kind of... you know, where you can, and they used to have like the number one team that would cross country ski into the cabins, and then the number two team, you know. So it was a good hearted fun. So I think it's great. Anyway, go on.
You know, you lived a great life, Bob Jackson. I'm going to tell you. Now you're raising buffalo in Iowa. My Lord.
Yeah.
I have a question.
A lot of yeah, go ahead.
I have a question for Bob Jackson. So, Bob, are you familiar with David Paulides, who wrote those series of books, Missing 411?
I don't know what you're referring to. No, I don't. I don't think so. 411?
So he wrote a series of books called Missing 411, and basically he, I think it was like over a period of 5 years, he basically researched missing persons reports from national and state parks all over the country. And mm-hmm. he was able to identify certain patterns. And without giving too much away, because really, if anyone hasn't read those books, they're just, both fascinating and terrifying, because a lot of them were unsolved. So I was just wondering if you were familiar with any of those books and what you thought about, some of the cases he outlines in those books are just, absolutely astounding. Billy, you're in the process of reading that, aren't you?
Yeah, I've got the one that's based mostly, on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And, there's some, I never realized how many people went missing, even on the Appalachian Trail. I mean, there's a lot of people that go missing. You just don't hear
one
about
of the,
it.
We'd, where I patrol out of is 30-some miles back in, and the outfitters that were outside the park during the elk hunting season, they even had to travel a little further to get through the wilderness area. And I still get calls once in a while from a deputy sheriff in Jackson Hole, where some of the guys take in a guy, some of the radical religious groups, and to go hunting, and even there were people feuding, whatever, and they don't come out. It happens a lot more than you think, but those are mostly murders. But, they say a bear got them, it's the end of the fall, and so they can't really do anything until springtime, and, what are they going to do? How are they going to find it? So it's just missing persons, but at the same time, it's probably because it's a lawless land back there. So
what you're telling us, Bob, is if we have a new friend that comes along and says, hey, I want to take you hiking in the wilderness in Yellowstone in the fall, we should probably decline.
If it's that back in my country, yeah.
Hey, Larry, what are you doing
place.
This fall?
It's a great. If you don't want to get caught and you want to kill somebody, that's a great place because it doesn't. None of the law enforcement, is able to really do much about that type of killings. There isn't any of the evidence. The bears are going to get them, the wolves or whatever, mostly the bears. And, you're just not going to find a person. So without a body, what are they going to do? So that's probably, no one knows about that one, but, that's how they kill people back there. So
the
that's a missing person, but go ahead.
No, I said the world's at it now.
I was just going to ask Bob if you had ever personally been involved, like in the missing persons case where you had to do a search and rescue or have you ever like found a body out there?
Parts of bodies when bears get them. Mm. You find out pretty soon that the front quarters have more food value than a hind quarter does. In other words, they'll eat the body of a human starting from inside the belt all the way up through the top, and they'll leave the legs and the shoes and that for last. So that's bodies, but as far as missing persons, probably the neatest one, if you want to call it neat, it was a missing hunter. They didn't know where it was. Could have wandered in the park. They didn't know he was on foot. This is in the west side of the park down north of Beckler, between West Yellowstone and Beckler. And so they had people outside the park looking in grids and inside the park looking, and my boss and I thought, hey, we're going to choose this grid. I mean, we were just as effective, but it was a flying fortress that had crashed in World War II down in that country, and it was still everything there, and we found it, And then we weren't the only ones. A helicopter crew had taken a .50 caliber out of there, but here it was, we packed up a bunch of .50 caliber bullets and, shells. And, it was kind of neat seeing the site, what it was. But they found the guy, outside the park. But that was one where you can use some individual enjoyment, if you want. It's just all a land of trees. And so no one would ever go down into that country. But that was a World War II flying fortress that crashed in there. So
course,
we got a plane.
A flying fortress? You mean it was an airplane that was what a bomber or?
Yeah, it's one of those big bombers where they have those the belly guns and the tail gunners mm-hmm. and really thick plexiglass or whatever it was in front, you know, where they had a lot of open vision. And as they were going across country or something like that, the military was during the war, and one of those flying fortresses, what are they, B-29s or something like that they called them? They called them flying
yes,
fortress?
Right. Yeah, I think it was the B-29, and then the B-52s were the Stratus. I think the B-52s yeah. were larger.
Yeah, and they were a little bit yeah. later, I think, than what yeah. the B-29 was. But, yeah, that was – it's still all mostly there, I'd say that thing is. So, you know, but there's others. There's planes up on the thoroughfare. There's one that you can still see the bones in the shoe, you know, right up high, you know, because it doesn't wow. deteriorate much. Missing persons, yeah, that's what I would do when people wouldn't show up. And mostly you track. You know, you don't track the way that people talk about, but you track them. You figure out where they're going to be between a pass, the same as a poacher, where he's going to be, and then you check those spots. And so you can make a lot more country than you can if you're just trying to follow tracks. Yeah.
Now, so, as far as I've always wondered, Bob, about these about the poachers. Now, when the poachers, would they actually travel in by foot, or would they go in on horseback?
Just about everybody that I had down in there was horseback because it was too far in for people on foot. Yeah. In the northwest section of the park where there was sheep hunting, where I patrolled from 74 to 78, I guess it was, sheep hunters or poachers are on foot. And most everything down in my country... And they would just like the movies, you know, anytime you have a stream crossing the boundary, then they may follow it up a half a mile or something like that on their horses so they're not leaving tracks. Or mm-hmm. what another thing they'd do is they'd come in on tracks where it'd be fairly easy to see the tracks, you know, on the ground. And then they'd go into a big bunch of spruce and lots of needles and circle around, and then you'd see tracks coming back. And you think, oh, they were in the park, but they didn't get anything. You know, maybe they went in a mile or so. And but then you're thinking, man, there's more tracks going in than there were out. And so what they do is they leave sets of tracks. You know, these are horse tracks. And then they go back in the same spot, and then they'd head out over some really dangerous, you know, where they're jumping horses, you know, leading them, jumping them maybe 4 or 5 feet. You know, on little ledges, you know, that you think, how in the heck are they doing that to a horse? But that's what they do. Yeah, so most of it back there was horse. Yeah.
Now, Bob, considering how easy it is for a person just to disappear, did it ever occur to you that, so when you track these poachers, you were doing it solo. Did it ever occur to you that, you know, you should get backup before you confronted them?
Mm-hmm. I don't want to make it sound like, you know, I was better than them or whatever, but maybe if I would have had a buddy, you know, that I could depend on, but there really wasn't, and it was a lot safer if you were on your own. If I did have a guy, like one time he was a big 6'5" guy, and, you know, we had a shotgun along, and I just told him to stay. There's like 4 poachers, and they'd tried to get out of the park, and they'd made it out during the night. But we rode enough to, I knew about where they'd have to camp out of the park. So we were there before daylight, and you always leave your horses about a half a mile behind. You don't want any scent where any horses are winning. But then you're just staking it out until you see them get their fire and, you know, for breakfast or whatever, and you see where their guns are, and then you just go in if it's a situation like that. And, you know, the other guy, I had him stay probably 40 yards out of camp, and I just told him to hold the shotgun, you know, down along by his belt, you know, just sideways. And I said, don't say a word the whole time. They're going to try to bring you in on it probably, but you're just going to stay there with the shotgun. And that was the most effective of all because they... You know, it takes a couple, 3 hours once you come in on them. And mm-hmm. they all have a story, you know, and then when they finally, the story busts down and it's all high intensity and it's almost like a domestic type thing as far as emotion goes for those guys. But that's why they all cry, you know. Seasoned guys, they just start tears coming down, and they hate you 2 weeks later. But yeah, if you have a second guy, he's going to screw it up for you. Yeah, the only thing you do is you notify if you can get out on a radio. A lot of times you're in draws and that you can't get out, but if you can get out, you can say you got something. There's no way they can get to you anyway. And if you wait till morning or something like that, you know, to get help coming in, you know, they're going to have you bring in a helicopter, and those guys are going to hear it even a mile or two away. So you take care of it, you know, on your own. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question, but it was safer doing it on your own than it was. If I would have had somebody, I did have a guy that was a venture capitalist that helped me. He came out for 10 days. He used to be a ranger, and he would help me. We'd set up a stakeout camp up in high country and get the horses out of there and then hike back up, and you might make a 10-day patrol out of there. You know, and so with him, then I'd basically have him just keep watching things. You know, if I was on guys, I'd just, you know, I'd say, hey, you stay with the guide and I'll be with the hunter. And the guide would want to try to talk to him, but you split the two guys up, and usually you can get the one guy better. And so if you can split them, that is an advantage of having a second guy. And so you maybe have them 200 yards apart or something like that, and then you start working the one guy is what you do. And pretty soon their head goes down and, you know, the tears come out, and you just have them write their confession. And they're usually pretty dramatic testimonies. Like, I knew I was in the park because I was hunting here last week. You know, like,
wow.
Yeah.
Gosh.
I was a guide that did that one. So, I don't know. I'm probably talking too much. Well, what's your question involved in that? And so, but it is just like the movies, except it's, I never had to shoot anybody. You pull your gun. Everybody out there is armed, of course. There was a couple of them that one guy just got out of prison, and the buddy, you know, wanted to kind of not go along, but the guy in prison said, I don't want to go back to prison right away, and so he kind of, you know, anyway. So you do have some bad guys. The real professionals, the guys that were the sheep poachers that would hunt Alaska, hunt Russia, you know, hunt Yellowstone backcountry. Those are the cool dudes, you know. They're sophisticated. They know what they're doing. And you talk to them, and it's not the emotion, you know, like you get with the outfitters and the guides. So those guys are on foot. Yeah, they're on foot.
Yeah.
And the bow hunters were the only other ones. They started taking bow hunters the last 10 years or so. Most outfitters didn't like bow hunters hunting elk because that meant so many of them are wounded, and then they wouldn't be able to have those for the hunters during the regular season. But economy and, you know, trying to get more animals, and so then they started doing that. But there was more hunting on foot where they'd leave their horses maybe 2 miles back and then hunt on foot. And, of course, you know, no sound. So it was a lot harder trying to catch somebody poaching with a bow and arrow. Although one guy did have a silencer on his gun. So, but you're shooting subsonic when you're doing that.
Yeah.
What was the hairiest situation you were in when you're tracking down these poachers? Like, do you ever think, like, I may not make it on the other side of this, you know, situation?
Probably the worst one is one that didn't happen. You know, it's like where you got a outfitter that you know goes through that area, and you do all the tracking and everything, so you know the illegal route, the game trail they take, and they always make circles. They never go back. They always make circles, just like wolves do and everything else. And so you get a place where you're, you know, you have a stakeout tent. You know, your cabins are 13 to 16 to 19 miles apart, so you can't patrol those very good. From you can check for tracks and stuff, but once you see a pattern, then you'll have a couple of 55-gallon barrels with a lid on it that you can clamp down, and you'll put a wall tent in there, and you'll put your sheep herder stove and, you know, hobbles and pickets and white gas and, you know, anything that you need, and then you leave those in there. You pack them in, and then you go there every year, and they're no more than, you know, within a mile and a half of the boundary because you don't want anybody to ever see it. So then when you're going to your stakeout spot, then it's always in the dark, and you got a flashlight taped to your rifle, and you're not trying to make any tracks. You got to know where to go where you're on grass, because you don't ever want them to see it. And this one, it was like I'd probably done 5-6 years of it, and you could only devote maybe 10 days at the very most in one area. And, of course, here it was, and there's a knife ridge, and you hear the hooves coming up, you know, and you're up against this dug fir, and it's come daylight, and you're looking down on the Bridger Lake down below in the valley, and but you hear the hooves coming, and boy, I tell you, after that many years, and you're just waiting and waiting, and all those times when you didn't get anything, and finally it's there, and you hear some voices down there, and you're waiting, and nothing happens. You know, as it turned out, it was a blowdown, and it had gone across that knife ridge, and so they couldn't get past it, so they had to go back. So that was one where I was breathing hard. I mean, it's like, you know, it wasn't a place where they could run from. It was, you know, only one place I could get them. And that means confrontation right there happening, and horses can't turn around in that spot, and all I got's a dug fur right there to stay on. So that one I was always leery of because something could happen that, you know, because it's excitement all at once for everybody. So that's one that didn't happen. So I got them later. You know, set the state record for Wyoming for a single offense. So we got their horses. We got saddles. We got everything off of them. And he was a couple guys out of Jackson Hole with an outfitter camp that the hunter told him. He told him he'd give him $10,000 to get a good size. He was a doctor out of Florida. And he said, I'm not going back without it. So the two guys went in to get it. So it was the same guys. So I did get them. But and they have different names up there. Yeah, they have different names. I mean, they're actually named. Their real names are kind of having to do with horses or whatever. I mean, I don't know if they changed their names, but I can't say the names over the phone. I mean, over the radio here, but they're committed to what they're doing. I can tell you that. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So,
before we have to leave tonight, we need to talk about your Bigfoot encounter.
Okay, Bigfoot.
Never heard it.
Okay. Ask a question, Larry.
Well, I'll start from the very beginning. Your encounters and your knowledge that this thing was existing in Yellowstone National Park.
Yellowstone definitely has Bigfoot. There's a couple areas that they're in more than others. You go up in the southeast corner area of up Mountain Creek, up into Howell Creek and the pass up above and Fishhawk Pass. It's an area that even the Indians said that's the home of Bigfoot or Sasquatch or whatever they called the name. But that one we have three, four of the sounds, and the one I recorded it was right behind the cabin up there, and it was right before dark or right at dark, and that one was 26 seconds long, without a breath. Mm-hmm. And it's real rocky. It's a stream right behind there, and I checked next morning. I couldn't find any tracks. But the first time I had heard what I didn't know what it was is an Upper Fane Creek, and I was with an outfitter, and it was the summertime. And he'd dropped the fishermen off to do the fishing on a little lower down, and him and a guide were checking out just country. So I always check out country. Over half of my travels were off trail. And I don't know. They say I've traveled 60 to 70,000 miles in Yellowstone.
Wow.
So, you know, it's what I did. It's what my adventure was. And I always said if I, because I found so much Indian sign that I found more campsites actually than all the rest of Indian sites ever found in Yellowstone, like more than anything, or more than all of them combined. But, you know, you could travel their routes. And anyway, we were just talking, standing on our, you know, sitting on our horses, and this thing up Upper Fan, Stellaria Creek, just starts making this noise, and just kind of like a thousand elk going to the death, or kind of like 10 Tarzans going, and it just kept going, and it was probably 2-3 miles away from us, but the volume of it, and it never took a breath. And I always thought, and those other guys didn't know either, what the heck is that? So it was about 2 weeks after that that I was coming back out of my Sportsman Lake cabin, and there's a pass up in there a little bit higher, and you got your subalpine fir thickets. They're really thick, and they kind of go from a point, and they're maybe 40 yards wide at the most, where the youngest trees are on the outside. In fact, when you're skiing in the wintertime and you got 5 feet of snow you're skiing on, you can go in the middle of those thickets and there's not a bit of snow in there. It's just that thick and that dark in there. It's a great place to, you know, find things from early trappers. In fact, you know, I found old skis in there, and not ever any traps, but, you know, where they'd stash things from year to year, where they do their illegal mountain or marten trapping down there. So anyway, I was coming out of the cabin and coming up on this ridge, and it's up pretty high. And it's probably a 60, 80 acre, I don't know, meadow, and there's probably 6 or 7 or 8 of those subalpine fir thickets up there in that meadow. And I was up above them in the trees, probably 40, 50 yards, and it was fairly steep. But treed, the trail was, and, you know, where you get to the flat of the meadow below. And all at once, my horses, you know, I can't remember if I had 1 or 2 pack horses and then, you know, my riding horse. And all at once, they started flaring their noses, just wham, 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 which means it's always meant a grizzly bear, you know. So, you know, but they're looking down below, and they're wanting to get out of there. And I'm looking because there's not seeing anything, except all at once I saw this little deer right on within a foot or two of the edge of one of these subalpine fir thickets. And it was just standing there. And I thought, how can there be a deer there? And it's exactly right down below there where the horses were. So I was trying to hold the horses, and it was steep enough that you can't hold them very long and something like that. Otherwise, they start sliding off of the trail, and it wouldn't have rolled down, not that steep, but at the same time, you can get the ropes twisted around and horses turn one way and, you know, another horse turn the other way. And so, and you can get ropes around trees, and you don't want that to happen. So I probably held them, 25, 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. I could hold it in, you know, in place, trying to see, and all at once that deer shot straight out into the meadow, and a split second later, out comes this thing out the other end of this subalpine fir thicket. And I thought first, oh, bear, you know, there's the bear, you know, because everything in my mind was thinking bear. But this thing was running on two legs, and it never did look at me, like I said. And it didn't run super fast, but the arms were down along the leg. Or, I mean, the fur was sort of like a bear, and it was pretty black. It was not pitch black, but it was definitely not brown. It was black or color. And I don't think it was a 7 foot high. But the arms were one like a human run, you know, where your arms are bent at the elbow. They're long arms. And it wasn't like it was in a, you know, 100 yard day speed, but it was definitely running. But this thing, it ran parallel with me for just a bit until it got into the other thicket. Then it went around the backside of that, and then it cut to another thicket, and then another thicket, and another one. In other words, it picked up cover as it went through the middle and get, oh, to the southwest, which would have been within a half mile where we'd heard that sound 2 weeks earlier or so. So it was, it picked up cover the whole way until it got into the heavy woods, you know, kind of mostly opposite me, but that's what it did. And I've never seen an animal pick up cover ever, whether it's a grizzly bear or anything. This thing, I thought, wow, that was a Bigfoot. And I said, yeah, you know, it was doing a zigzagging, you know, it was catching cover. But so I could see it, you know, several times in between those thickets. So after I'd seen that, of course, then I started, well, I put the sound together with what I thought was what I saw. And so then I started asking outfitters and people, you know, whether it was down in that southeast corner of the park or the northwest part up and through there. And, you know, probably four or five different people. One guy was an outfitter out of the Jackson Hole. He's dead now, but he definitely heard the same thing I had. And one time we were skiing, a 10-day ski trip in the backcountry, and it was close to the south entrance going into Heart Lake Cabin and up on what they call Paycheck Pass. That's where the guys in the CCC days would get paid halfway in. So there we were skiing, and of course it's March. That's when you do a lot of your skiing because, you know, you got big backpacks on and you got all the survival stuff. And so if you do it too much earlier, the day lengths are short and the snow isn't set up. So all at once, there's four of us, another biologist, myself, and anyway, these tracks cross perpendicular to, you know, this the Wendany River. We were following the trail because you have orange markers, but it's 5 feet of snow or so. And these tracks were pretty definite right into the snow. It wasn't like snowshoe hair or something that's going through fluff and it makes a wider, you know, pattern. Or sure. Coyotes can do it. This was pretty straight. And so I stretched my ski out as far as I could go. And it was about as far as I could stretch from 1 foot to the next. And it was a big track. Probably, we didn't measure it, but it was probably 18 inches or so.
Wow.
Just like a footprint, you know, somebody without shoes on going across there. And it was probably 2-3 inches of snow that it was laying those tracks down in. So anyway, down in that same area, and he's a real competent ranger. He took a report from a visitor that was at Beulah Lake. It's a real small lake a couple miles west of the south entrance. And he said he'd watched one for about 10 minutes. And that was in the mid-70s when he watched this Bigfoot on the other side of the lake. And he was on the one side and that Bigfoot was on the other.
Sure.
So I don't know, trail crew or blister rust crew, that would have been in the 70s too. They were, of course, doing their ribes or current eradication at that time. And that was down near that Mountain Creek area I talk about that's had a number of where the sounds or where people hear it. But it was off the trail, and they came upon just moist, deboned elk, and here are these big, huge footprints, and it scared them so much that they took out that night instead of staying, you know, in a cabin. And they said, you know, this is what they said: they could hear something behind them in the dark, and of course, no one could have firearms unless you're a ranger then. And so, trail crew and those guys would carry cherry bombs and firecrackers with them, you know, for bears. And they'd throw one of those off behind them once in a while. But they said those were the weirdest sounds they heard back behind them. Man, it was scary, they said. So, and those were seasoned guys. They'd been in there, you know, doing that a number of years off trail. So then after the 88 fires, no reports, anything. I didn't have anything. But then in the mid to late 90s, trail crew again on Upper Mountain Creek going into or towards our Hollow Creek cabin. They heard one, same sounds, everything, middle of the day, and that was up in towards Table Mountain was where they heard that one, which would have been about 2 miles away from where I heard it that one time where I timed it at 26 seconds. So anyway, yeah, there's Bigfoot there, and they stay mostly, from what I can see, in really dense dense woods, more of the spruce, that type of stuff. It's a little bit wetter in those areas, and that burnt a lot of that stuff did in the 88 fires. So I think it took them out of that area there for a while.
Yeah.
But, yeah, but, you know, as far as finding skeletons or anything else, people around the country, you know, all those times I was off trail, I found two bear skulls, you know, carcass. Well, the one was a bear skull and the other was a carcass or a skeleton in all that time. And one was a black bear on a poacher trail, and the other was a grizzly bear up on top of the Trident. I'd always take a flashlight with me to look in caves, because you can find some pretty neat stuff, Indian stuff in caves. One time I found a spear in there where they blocked the front off to poke at sheep on this narrow ledge, which is kind of neat. I took an archaeologist up there to show them it. But this carcass was a grizzly bear, and it was in, it was a cave in behind a waterfall, and you crawl in there, and that's where they'd winter, you know, hibernate. And
sure.
It was like a 2 or 3 year old. And that's all I found in all those years.
Yeah.
So if there's a lot less Bigfoot than there are bears, so I could see how you'd never see one or a dead one.
Yeah. Bob, you don't know how much we appreciate you coming on tonight. It's always mesmerizing listening to your stories, and our listeners are just, by the response that we get after our shows, it's just incredible, the listener response. And tonight you did it once again. We just appreciate it so much.
Thank you. It's good to share it.
Oh, we're so glad.
People say I should write a book, but...
You should.
I don't know. I've had people that want to author it, and then you find out that once they write the book, you know, and that can either be the ghostwriter or co-author and stuff like that, then what they do is you don't have any rights to anything that you said after that. You know, and what they do is they sell them to script writers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so then you don't have any control of what happens after that.
No.
Sierra Club wanted me to write a book, and they have contract writers, and that's what you find out what they do. So maybe someday, but I don't know. I guess you know, the motives for doing it are something higher up than what, you know, they're not doing it ready to write for me. They're doing it because they can make money further up on the script writing or making it into something. So we'll see.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Got a little bit over a minute. Bruce, Billy, give one more plug for your event.
Well,
okay.
I was gonna say, Bob probably doubled the listenership of Larry's show.
Yeah.
There's four people listening to it right now.
Yeah.
But I thought Bob's, you know, accounts were
there's four
fascinating.
People listening right now. He doubled it.
That's real funny. Yeah, that's not true, Bob.
I caught it. Don't worry.
But Bob, your accounts are pretty fascinating. And I hope you do write a book about your, you know, just your trials and tribulations out there. Not only your Bigfoot hunting, but poaching and what it's like just to be on your own out, you know, out in the bush there.
Are you done,
so,
Bruce? Good.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World.
sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks, Bob.